So today we're in the eastern realm of the mandala. And in the east we find the deep blue Buddha Akshobhya. So we can imagine him appearing out of a vast blue sky, absolutely clear. And he's seated on a lotus throne supported by elephants. Seated on a lotus and a white moon mat, his body made of dark blue light. So he appears, but there's nothing that you can grasp hold of. He appears like a rainbow in the sky. And he's dressed in silks and jewels, representing the fact that he's developed all the qualities of generosity, ethics, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. And with his right hand, he's making the gesture of touching the earth. So it's down by his right knee, palm turned inwards, just the fingertips touching the bedrock of reality, touching how things really are. And in his left hand, which is perfectly relaxed, just lying in his lap, upright, perfectly balanced, stands a golden vajra, a diamond thunderbolt. And he's smiling. He's smiling at us. His serene awareness embraces us. And his whole body and head give off auras of light. So this figure, Akshobhya, is the Buddha that we are contemplating through today. And as we saw last week, within the mandala is the whole of our life. So there are natural associations with Akshobhya that all take their place in the eastern realm. So there's colour, there's blueness, there's the east, there's the dawn, and there's water, and even natural flora and fauna, such as the elephant. And then there are a range of more spiritual associations. There's the Bodhisattva, Vajrapani, he who holds the diamond thunderbolt. There's mirror-like wisdom. And actually, you can also have a female consort, Lodshinar. And there's the deep blue seed syllable, Hung, which is a symbol of integration. So last week, when I talked about Akshobhya, I focused mainly on how he developed from contemplation of Buddha Shakyamuni's life and enlightenment. And in particular, I focused on an incident called Calling the Earth Goddess to Witness, where Mara embodies all the forces, internal and external, that hold us back from attaining wisdom, from developing compassion. Mara appeared in the story, in the sort of inner tale of what happened at the time of the Buddha's enlightenment, and he challenged the Buddha, saying, by what right do you sit on the Vajra seat, the point where all Buddhas gain enlightenment? And so Mara is trying to kind of undermine the Buddha's confidence, you can say. So Mara is as an internal voice, is a last voice of sort of self-doubt, of self-questioning. Who am I? You know, what's so special about me that I can see the truth, that I can gain enlightenment? And in response, the Buddha just touched the earth and calls up the earth goddess, who testifies to the fact that, yes, the Buddha is ready. He has developed the merits and done the practice which have set up the conditions for him to be right on the point of enlightenment. So we mainly focused on that incident, although we looked at a lot of other things as well. A lot to do with confidence, a lot to do with dwelling in the present moment, a lot to do with integration, with being in the body, with being grounded. So in this talk, I'm going to go into other areas, but maybe it's just worth drawing out a couple more points from that incident of Mara questioning the Buddha. The first one is just that Mara's attempt to draw the Buddha away from that central place. It's a questioning. It's asking him to provide evidence. And it's interesting just to watch in our own practice, on our own level, how often we can have some kind of intuition or some kind of deep feeling, some kind of sense of the way we should go or what we should do. And then our rational mind comes along and says, well, what's your evidence for that? Come, why? You know, you're having this kind of intuition. But what proof have you got that if you go that way, it's going to work? And very often we argue ourselves out of our deeper intuitions. We don't apply them because the rational mind comes in and demands evidence, which intuition by its nature can't give. So it's just a point to reflect on. More generally, for a lot of us, that rational working is the kind of control aspect of the mind. One of the things which happens as you start going further on the path, as you start going into Buddhism, is that other aspects of yourself start coming to the fore, and your heart opens. You start to have deep feelings emerging. You go more into the body, you go more into just sort of physical experience. And as I say, your spiritual intuition opens up. And all that, in a way, is a challenge to the power and control of the rational. The rational, you know, gets kind of swept away if you have a really strong, you know, upwelling of grief, say. It finds itself getting quieter and quieter, and its voice getting smaller and smaller as you go deeper into the body and your direct experience in that way. And it doesn't know what to do with your intuitions at all, because they just don't compute. So part of the task in our, certainly in our earlier practice of the Dharma, is to not give up rational development at all. You know, the rational mind is a wonderful thing. None of us would have even made it to Padmaloka, you know, just in terms of getting in the car or whatever, if we didn't use it. But it's a good servant and a bad master. Yeah, so part of our practice is encouraging the rational mind just to move over a bit, just to stop using its elbows and kind of taking up all the space, and to allow all the other faculties and richness of ourselves as a human being to also have space, to really come into play, so that we really feel our feelings, so we can really develop our feelings. Yeah, so we're really in our senses, so we're really in our body. And so, yes, we can have those intuitions, you know, those sort of spiritual intuitions about things that the rational mind doesn't understand, although it may make some sense to understand later why the intuition was correct. Because apart from anything else, awakening is said to be atakavachara, beyond the realm of rational thought. So it's going to be a bit difficult getting to awakening if we're just going to try and do it with our rational faculty, fantastic and useful as that is. I think the other little point about Mara's challenge is something about Mara saying to the Buddha, well, you know, who do you think you are to sit there? And on our level, I think there's something about us just taking ourselves seriously as Dharma practitioners. Not in a ego-based, I am a great yogi way. Not in a solemn, this has all got to be deadly serious because there is no room for laughter. But that we actually have the confidence in the Dharma that if the Dharma really works, the Dharma works for human beings. We are a human being, and therefore it will work for us. And it's quite easy to practice for years and years, kind of going along, doing a bit, doing a bit of meditation, a bit of practice here and there, a bit of study, meeting some friends and talking about the Dharma and how it's all going, but never really kind of getting down to it. Partly, I think a lot of us almost, it's almost a sense as if this isn't really it. Almost like this isn't quite our life. This is like the rehearsal. As if it's not the real thing. And then you wake up, at a certain point after so many years when you've got quite a lot older and you realise, oh, this isn't the rehearsal. This is the play, and now we're in Act 3, and I'm not quite sure how many more acts there are to go. And, the plot has thickened quite a lot, and I'd better really kind of get down to it. So, this is it. And often just out of that sense of not quite giving things their full reality, and also just out of a lack of confidence, which is partly, we all have our difficulties and our things that we struggle with, but it's partly a kind of lack of confidence in the Dharma. We don't quite take ourselves seriously, and that's just a real shame, because any of us, all of us here, if we just take ourselves seriously, if we take our practice seriously, can really put an end to a great deal of suffering for ourselves and have a big effect on everyone else that we come in contact with. Okay, so that was all appendices to last Saturday. So today I want to move on and look at the Vajra. So last week we looked more at Akshobhya's right hand. This week we're going to look more at his left hand. So we have the diamond thunderbolt. And there's an awful lot of we could say about that. I wrote a small book called The Vajran Bell, which says a lot about it. But basically, it's a stylized scepter. So it's like a scepter that a king might hold. So there's something, there's that kind of symbolism of something regal there. And that stylized scepter is a stylized thunderbolt and a stylized diamond. I'm not going to go into all the symbolism of the individual bits of the Vajra. You can see if you can find that little book on the Vajra and Bell if you want to do that. So there are these two, in a way, quite contradictory or apparently contradictory elements. There's the beauty of the diamond, but also, probably more important in terms of this symbolism, was the fact that the diamond cannot be cut. The diamond is so hard, yeah? So there's something completely stable about it. There's something unshakable, immovable about it, which connects with Akshobhya's name. But then there's also this tremendous dynamism. There's all this dynamism and power of the thunderbolt. And I said before that when you approach one of these figures, it's as if you're looking in a mirror. And essentially, you're looking into the mirror of your mind. And you're looking at the potential of your own mind. So that means that somewhere, at least deep in the depths of our mind, perhaps deep in the depths of the water, that's the element of Akshobhya, deep in a lake somewhere, like a sword in the Arthurian legends, is the diamond thunderbolt. That says something about us and our mind and our qualities that we can develop. So let's look at diamonds and thunderbolts for a little while. Let's start with... I haven't got a coin on me. Diamonds. Okay, diamonds. So yes, we've said that the diamond is something very stable, something immovable. And so it has the qualities... It suggests that we have the potential for our mind to become stable, imperturbable. This also relates to the elephant. Actually, the elephant has a bit of both the qualities of the Vajra. It's not very fast moving like a thunderbolt, but it's pretty irresistible once it gets going, unless you happen to be the Buddha sort of standing there making the Upaya Mudra in front of it. And the elephant is also tremendously sort of heavy and stable and powerful. You don't move an elephant very easily. So this suggests that we have a capacity for states of mind that are unruffled, states of mind of, you could say equanimity, but I don't find equanimity kind of moves me very much. I don't know about you. So I tend to think often when Buddhism talks about equanimity, I tend often to translate that in my own mind into serenity. I have a much more heartfelt response to being serene than I do to being equanimous. Somehow serenity is equanimity plus joy. And I find that really, I do find that really attractive. There's a sense of stability of the mind just staying where it's put very happily, resting on its object of concentration, resting in its own nature even. And reminds me of the story about the king and the Buddha, where the Buddha asked the king how long he could happily sit doing nothing. Because the king assumes that he's much happier than the Buddha because he has a whole palace and servants and everything he wants. And the king hasn't quite expected that question, but he thinks he can sit happily for an hour, maybe. This is a king from 2,500 years ago where the pace of life is a bit slower. And the Buddha says, but, he could happily just sit without moving for a week and just experience complete serenity of mind. So where does that come from? You can say it comes out of development of states of shamatha, of deep calm. But finally, that sort of stability of mind really comes out of wisdom. And wisdom is the is a quality particularly associated with Axiopia. And one particular aspect of wisdom that's associated with Axiopia is called mirror-like wisdom, the wisdom that is like a mirror. Mirrors of showing reflections. And that mirror-like wisdom is particularly embodied when Axiopia has a female consort in the form of Lochana, which means she with the eye, she who sees clearly. So let's go into all this a little bit. In the mandala of the five Buddhas, we're in the world of Mahayana. That great sort of movement within Buddhism which emphasizes the bodhisattva ideal, compassion, and also sees wisdom in terms of what it calls emptiness, shunyata. So we're particularly concerned with emptiness, as in the Heart Sutra, where we talk about form is no other than emptiness, etc. I'm always wary of using the word emptiness because it's very easy, somewhere along the line, to turn it into a thing. There is a thing called emptiness, which is the real nature of things, which is not at all what's meant and not at all how things are. We're all right with an adjective. Shunyata is the noun. Shunya is the adjective. So things can be shunya. Things can be empty, as long as we understand that they're always empty of something. Otherwise, we make this sort of mistake where it's a bit like talking about, you can talk about someone being kind. You can also talk about kindness as a kind of abstract way of talking. But we know that kindness doesn't exist in the abstract, you know, in some kind of other realm, you know, separate. There are just people who are kind. Yeah. Kindness just is a way, a convenient noun to talk about, yeah, the fact that people are kind. That's really, in our experience, what we're talking about. So similarly, when we talk about emptiness, there is no such thing as abstract emptiness. There are experiences which are empty of any kind of inherent existence, which are empty of having any kind of fixed core, anything about them which is unchanging. So that's really all we're talking about. Very often in texts where it says such and such is empty, again, I do a translation job in my own mind, and I substitute the word ungraspable, because that just gives a sense, you know, you don't take ungraspability as some kind of separate real nature of things. That doesn't make any sense. Yeah, but so, and that sense that things are ungraspable, that finally you can't get hold of them, gives you a sense of what emptiness is really referring to. Yes, you know, I can get hold of my watch, but eventually, if I cling on to it long enough, it will, even this Seiko, whatever it is, will come apart in my hands. So, yeah, things are empty, and all this just follows on from basic Buddhism. The basic principle of the Dharma is that everything arises in dependence on conditions. And because conditions keep changing, so everything is impermanent. And because everything is impermanent, it's ungraspable. There are no things. There are just so nothing ever gets to the point of being stable enough to be a thing. There's almost just an interplay of conditions, a vast sort of network of forces interacting fundamentally. There's nothing fixed. There's nothing completely inherently existent, sort of in the middle of things or behind things. And that applies to us too. that sense that we have a sort of me standing behind my experience to which we refer back. When we look at that, when we look into that, we find that that's ungraspable just as much as anything else. And that's one of our tasks in insight meditation. So we have this ungraspable nature of experience. And yet still, everything appears. This is the part of what the visualization sadhanas are trying to get you to see, if you practice one of those. We saw that akshobhya appears out of this ungraspable blue sky, out of this open dimension of mind. And even when he appears, still his body isn't solid, it's made of light. And that's just to show us, to keep reminding us, that there's nothing about him. Yes, there's nothing about him that we can get hold of. So in that way we have the middle way of Buddhism. You know, one aspect of the middle way is that it's a middle way between eternalism and nihilism. There's nothing kind of eternally fixed and present about akshobhya. There's nothing you can get hold of. Yeah, there's just the empty space. But at the same time, there's the appearance of the form. So there's obviously not nothing, because that appearance affects you. If you visualize akshobhya, if you're an akshobhya devotee and you visualize him day after day after day, that empty appearance deeply moves you. So akshobhya appearing but just made of light, ungraspable, is a demonstration of the middle way. It's not that anything truly, finally exists and exists for all eternity, not even shunyata, because that doesn't exist at all, nor is there just nothing. There are continual arisings, independence on conditions. There's a continual dance of appearance. There's always experience. There's always more experience. Impermanence doesn't just mean everything comes to an end. There is always transformation. One thing, so to speak, comes to an end, something else arises. There's just a flow of experience, and that's made possible by the fact that everything arises in dependence on conditions. So we've been looking at this in terms of akshobhya. We can also look at it in terms of a mirror. So in a mirror, things appear. Whatever you hold in front of the mirror, there it appears. But with a mirror, we know that there's no point in trying to cling on to what's there, because it's just a reflection. So we see it clearly, there it is, but there's no attempt to grasp onto it. There's no sense of, if I just have this mirror reflection, I will be totally happy. We know the nature of it. We understand the nature of it. But in everyday life, which is just like a mirror, inasmuch as there's nothing real there, nothing that we can finally grasp onto and hold onto, we forget. We forget the nature of things. We forget that everything is an arising independence on conditions. We forget that it's bound sooner or later to change and transform. We forget that the Buddha said something about how, you know, clinging onto things causes suffering. And we live in a world very often of a rather fixed reality, where there are things which we, possessions of which we have control, people who we need to be stable for our own security, and a stable me that's experiencing it all. But what Buddhism is saying is that that's, even modern science is saying, is that that's just a terribly clunky way to operate. And out of that clunky way of operating, we clunk into other people with their clunky ways of operating. And we all suffer as a result. So it's important as part of our practice that we are just taking the wisdom side of Buddhism seriously. To start off, reflect on conditionality and impermanence and the ungraspable nature of things, that there is just a flow of experience. And that moves us some way from wrong view to right view, or at least righter view. But it takes quite a long time for it really to go deep, for it really to be strong enough to destroy our clinging to a sense of, you know, this is how things are, to that sense of a very kind of rigid, concrete reality. And part of the way in which we need to operate, as well as just changing our thinking, changing our worldview, is to be going into our experience through mindfulness, through meditation, so that we actually come to see directly the nature of how things are. That will be what we'll really do. We'll really do the work. So in meditation, we can become concentrated as much as we can. Sometimes, on a good day with the following wind, we can become concentrated. And then we can just explore our experience, even just simple experience of the body. And as we do that, what do we actually find? What do we actually find? When I do it, what do I find? Well, I find, say, if I put my awareness into what I call my hand, which is an idea, my actual experience is of visual impression, of sensations, of warmth, slight pleasure, slight constriction where I'm wearing a ring which has got Om Mani Padme Hum on it around one of my fingers. So I just go into my experience as deeply as I can. And we're trying to get down to the level of that very well-known story in the Pali Canon where there's a man called Bahia who comes to see the Buddha. He's desperate. He's come from a long way. He's very devoted to the Buddha, and he's desperate for a teaching. And he turns up where the Buddha is, and the Buddha's gone off on his arms round. But Bahia is so desperate to see the Buddha that he goes after him, and he catches up with him, and he wants the Buddha to teach him. And the Buddha politely explains that this isn't a very good time because he's just gathering his food for the day. But Bahia won't take no for an answer. He keeps on asking. And eventually, if you ask a Buddha three times, the Buddha will definitely give you an answer. The Buddha kind of, you almost feel the Buddha kind of rolling up the sleeves of his robe and going, "All right, Bahia, you want an answer, you want some teaching? Here it is." And the Buddha just says, "See things like this. In the scene, just the scene. In the herd, just the herd." And he goes through all the senses. So what the Buddha's saying is that we need to peel back all our ideas, all our concepts about how life is. In other words, we need to get underneath the story that we're telling ourselves about life and about ourselves. The story in which I always star in the story of my life. I am the key character and everything. I appear in every episode, and everything refers back to me. All the applause is for me, fundamentally. There's the story that we tell ourselves about life, and that is a story. So what we're aiming to do in meditation, in quite a simple way, is just to come back to, okay, well, what's our actual experience underneath the story? Because another aspect of this idea of emptiness, of shunyata, for the Mahayana, is that, yeah, things are ungraspable. They are ungraspable in words and concepts. Finally, your description of something doesn't do it justice. How could it? Words are extraordinary. They're amazing. Language is fantastic. It's incredible. But still, reality is infinitely more amazing, infinitely more fantastic. Language is fundamentally, sort of limited. Words go across the page, in nice marching straight lines. Reality is infinitely dimensional. So yes, you can't catch reality in words. So we need to dive beneath our story about life and get right into it and really experience it directly. So, okay, I've got a story about my hand and what it's like, and how it's doing after 62 years and so on and so forth. But then there's my actual experience, in which there's no such thing as a hand. A hand is just a word. Yeah? My story about it isn't this. Isn't this a living bit of flesh here? It's completely different. So we need to go into our experience deeply, into all our senses, and see what's there and learn from it. And when we do that, then we find, this amazing kind of flow of different experiences, all influencing one another, this kind of flow of causes and conditions. And we don't find anything we can get hold of. So it is. It's more like an image in a mirror. It's more like reflections. And the more we see that, the more we don't need to produce the story. And the more we are happy to just appreciate life without clinging onto it, because we know, we've seen. So life is so dynamic, and we're so dynamic, that creating a fixed sense of me that then has to kind of fix everything else so that it can control it, so that it can be happy, is just a way of functioning that is doomed to failure. So we let it go. And we let it go because we felt in our bones that it doesn't work, because we've got right into our awareness of our body, so we do feel things in our bones. We get right down there. So yeah, sure, we can interact with the world. We can interact more and more, but we're not fixing things. Not holding on to them. That gives us an immense freedom. And there's an immense amount of energy that goes into that whole process of fixing me and keeping the story going all through the day, and then making our experience fit the story. That is so tiring. That is so tiring. No wonder we're tired at the end of the day. And actually, when we go to sleep, we have to put down the whole story of me in order to go to sleep. Otherwise, we lie awake. It's the story that keeps us awake. Yeah, so when we come closer to our direct experience, as we can do on a retreat like this, we don't need to kind of think so much. We don't need to keep stimulating that story all the time. We can just come much closer to just looking at things, just listening to things, just feeling the body, just being aware of what's there, letting it come, letting it go, like a reflection in the mirror. And we build up a lot of energy, because we're not ploughing all that energy into that sort of ego project. So it's, as I say, it's not that we stop interacting. In fact, we become more interactive because we have more free energy And because we don't have a sense of this sort of me back at the centre of things holding back, we feel ourselves as part of life. We feel ourselves as part of the conditions for the whole of life to appear. And we're arising in dependence on the whole of life. So there's this fantastic sort of interaction. Incidentally, this kind of mirror-like wisdom on a more everyday level also just involves doing your best to be objective about how you are and who you are. We all have all sorts of ideas about ourselves. There are lots of experiments which show that, you know, most people think that they're better than average drivers. Most people presented with a series of photos of themselves and asked to pick out which is the current one, will pick one from 10 years ago, you know, a number of years ago when they look younger. So, you know, we're all tending to stand in front of the ego mirror and kind of preen ourselves in different ways. And yeah, we all need self-confidence. We all need, you know, that sense that we can get out and do our lives. But we also need to be standing on solid ground. We need to be standing on what's actually the case. Just seeing what's there. And if we do that, it also, yeah, it gives us stability. It gives us more of that Vajra kind of dharma and stability. It stops us from being blown around by some what are called the worldly winds, like praise and blame, or fame and infamy. Well, I think these days it's probably fame and obscurity. You know, the worst thing is, you know, not to have your 15 minutes in the sun, your 15 minutes of fame. There's even a practice in Tibetan Buddhism where you spend a lot of time meditating, just looking into a mirror. You just look at yourself in a mirror. And after you've done that for quite a while, then you start praising yourself. You tell yourself about all your wonderful qualities and everything you've done, and, you know, you start really kind of saying all those things you really wanted people to say, you know. So, you were right. You were right all along. Oh, yes, yes. All those things, yeah. And then you go to the other extreme and you start really laying into yourself and giving yourself a very hard time, blaming yourself and criticizing yourself. And you just watch and you just keep having this sense that it's all just a mirror reflection. In a way, the sound of your voice is like an echo. Now, what is it that we're getting so upset about? What do we actually gain when somebody praises us? All these things. So there are practices which just explore them. So going more and more, knowing ourselves better and better on all levels, right down to a sort of direct experience of the body, but also just knowing what we're like as people, just gives, and being happy with that, just as a starting point, gives us a stability in the midst of being pulled around by praise and blame and opinion and all those things. So, this is a brief introduction to mirror-like wisdom. There's a lot that we could unpack about it. And yes, the term is mirror-like wisdom. It's kind of interesting. It's almost like modern technology seems to be inventing more and more wonderful ways of demonstrating the nature of reality. But they just do it for entertainment purposes or other things a lot of the time. We had, you know, ancient India had reflections in water and basic kind of mirrors and things like that. Modern technology has all kinds of ways of presenting us with experience, but which is ungraspable, which isn't quite as it seems. And you have a 3D TV screen or something, yeah, and, you know, all sorts of things happen. You know, there's a a sporting event and there's a few murders and then there's some news and then there's a love affair and so on. And you sit and watch those, and if they were real, you'd have gone completely through the kind of ringer, in sort of a few hours, so if you just emerge, kind of traumatized and unbelieving. But you know that it's not finally real. Yes, it affects you. Yes, it moves you. Yeah, you care about it. But you don't kind of buy into it in a certain kind of way because you know that it's in a sense, not there. There is nothing there. Otherwise, you're like a cat sort of going behind the TV screen trying to work out where it's all going on. So modern technology gives us lots of opportunity to reflect on mirror-like wisdom, how things appear and have effects, but they are not finally real or graspable. And we can use those as reminders not to grasp. Yeah. All kinds of interesting things, kind of computers and Windows. Windows are really interesting. I'm not going to do an advert for Microsoft, but just that basic way in which on a computer you can go into all these different worlds. You just click on here and this world opens up, and click on there and that world opens up. You can really feel that in meditation a lot of the time. You're a bit concentrated, but not really concentrated. It's a bit like there are all these, on the edge of your awareness, there's this sense of all these worlds you could go into. You could just kind of click on that world, on that little, there's this little thing opening up in kind of like in the edge of your vision, as there you are with the breath. And if you were to go through it, through into that window, suddenly you'd be in, sort of shopping world or sex world or whatever it is. In meditation you get irritating pop-up windows too. I'll kind of leave mirror-like wisdom there. Just to say though that it is important that there is some kind of, we are doing this kind of work, both reflecting, checking out the Buddhist view of things against our experience, and if we find it works, then more and more, making that the story that we tell ourselves, and also going deep into our experience to see, really on that deep down level, how things are, to see that for ourselves. And it's also important, it becomes more important as you go on in your practice on all sorts of levels. Just as an aside for order members, I sometimes think that in order chapters, somebody has some difficult issue, perhaps they've got caught up in, they're still caught up in something that happened in the past and so on. And some order chapters are better than others, but often people are very good at just listening to that person, offering helpful suggestions, and even helping them to sort of look at the ethics of how they're acting. But maybe when we've been through the kind of the listening and the empathizing, the emotional understanding, the ethical level, maybe there also finally needs to be a wisdom element in there, that we also do what we can to help that person to see, that this whole situation that they're wrestling with is finally a story. If they're wrestling with something that happened 10 years ago, 10 years ago doesn't exist. 10 years ago has gone. So just to have that element in there. Okay, so that was Vajra as Dhammed. Now, rather more briefly, Vajra as Thunderbolt. So, we now have all the power of the Thunderbolt. And, briefly, two aspects of this. One is that Akshobhya is said to be associated with transmuting, transforming a poison. So there's a kind of alchemy at work for each of these five Buddhas. And Akshobhya's poison is the poison of hatred or wrathfulness. So how does Akshobhya transmute hatred or anger into wisdom? Partly, I think he probably does it like going beneath the story and just coming more directly into experience. There's something that I'll suggest to you, which some of you will know from years back or from reading Sangharakshita, is there's a way of working where he talks about unhooking. So let's see how that works with anger. Let's say that I'm in a bank and there's some official there who has just been very unpleasant to me and rude. So suddenly this flash of anger appears. I don't know where it came from, but suddenly it's just bang, there it is. So following Sangharakshita's advice, what I do is I work with what are called the three circles, the Trimandala, actually, in Mahayana thought. The situation, the conditions for the situation, the conditions for my anger are that I've separated out an object, a subject, and the activity that kind of links the two. So Sangharakshita suggests that, okay, if you want to work with the anger in this kind of situation, first off, you unhook from the object. So what does that mean? What it means is that I have to just let go, for the time being, of what the catalyst, the outside catalyst, that, as far as I'm concerned, is to blame, is causing my anger. I just let it go. I mean, if I'm in the situation, sure, I have to deal with the bank representative, I have to do something. But very often we can do this work more to start with in meditation. So you find anger arising about something. So first off, you just unhook it. You let go of what caused it. You know that that's the catalyst. That's just the trigger, in a way. Yeah, you're the one who's feeling angry, so you're the one who needs to transform it, because you're the one whose anger is not an enjoyable state of mind, usually. So you let go of the catalyst, and now there's just me feeling very angry. So you've let go of the object, unhooked from it, which leaves me and the anger. And now we do our best to let go of the subject. So we let go of this sense of me that feels angry. They did that to me. They were rude to me. And I'm describing it as if, you know, first you just do this and then you just do that. And then you may find it's not quite that straightforward. But first off, we get the idea, and, you know, we can work with the different stages. And I've not got very long if you're going to have a discussion group, so I'm going quick. So then you let go of you do your best to just let go of the subject. Yeah? Sometimes if you practice more insight meditation, you can look into it and just see that there is no subject there. There's just the anger. So that's what you're then left with. There's now just anger. There's just... there's that shaking in the body, there's all that going on. And then, third stage, you peel off the label. you let go of any sense that it's anger. And you just experience what's there. At which point you're, you know, in the shaking, just the shaking. Yeah? In the heat, just the heat. In the energy, just the energy. And if you do this, if you manage to do this deeply, then what started off as being, you know, this kind of rage because so-and-so did this to me, and what am I going to do, and I'll sort them out, and all that, which is a lot of suffering and difficulty, just comes down to anger, and then finally even the anger label goes, and you can just have energy. There's just an awful lot of energy, which, when you're not seeing it in that context of me and what happened and all that, starts to become available to you. It starts to, you can then lead it out of that situation. So that was a very brief guide to hooking and unhooking. But it suggests, at least, the way in which you can go in terms of getting into in touch with this idea of transmuting anger into mirror-like wisdom. Fundamentally, you're getting out of the story and back into your absolute direct experience. Okay, so that was a very brief look at the thunderbolt aspect of the Vajra. So we have diamond and thunderbolt. Akshobhya holds, sort of embodies the Vajra, embodies a Vajra state of mind. So he embodies all that potential that we have for stability and serenity of mind. Really not to be shaken, not to be pushed around by praise and blame, really not to get caught up in trying to cling on to things that change, really not getting thrown around by things which are like reflections in a mirror, which are like a dream, like a film, like a hologram, like whatever you want to think of. So that's one side of things. It's seeing the empty, ungraspable nature of things means that you don't attempt to interact with them in ways that don't work, that fundamentally fail. It means that you interact with them with a sense that they're constantly flowing, with a sense that they're, yeah, that you can play with them then, actually. There can be far more energy going into them. So that's one side. And then there's the thunderbolt side. There's the side of dynamism, energy, which is freed up when we manage to go deeply into our experience, come down to the level of how things are rather than our stories about them. When we let go of the story of me at the centre of the world, it's like that just sort of sucks in so much energy. So when we get underneath that, then suddenly there's a great freedom. So we have diamond, thunderbolt. We have another way of looking at it, finally, is that you have the complete openness of mind, which is like the diamond aspect, completely stable in as much as things are always like that. Whatever it is that appears, it's always just a dependent arising. It's always just impermanent. It's always just ungraspable. Doesn't matter what the experience is. You look at its nature, and that's how it is. When I left my 3-year retreat, people say it must have been a real shock coming back. And funnily enough, it kind of wasn't. I mean, suddenly, you know, from being in this very, very quiet, you know, amazingly sort of sleepy rural area of France, living, you know, hardly seeing anybody, spending hours and hours and hours a day meditating in this old wooden circus wagon, suddenly I'm kind of back, you know, back in the city, and there's thousands of people around, and I got 3 years' worth of news and information and friendships and things and what's happened in the order and Sri Ratna to catch up on. And, yeah, there's been a financial crisis and all sorts of things that have gone on without anybody asking me about it while I was away. All this stuff, you know, just coming at me, sort of a tremendous kind of speed. It's like life suddenly kind of, you know, going into fast forward and... But the nature of it didn't change. It was still impermanent. It was still ungraspable. It was still just arising dependence on conditions. So when I just looked at the nature of it, I felt quite stable. I didn't feel thrown around by it. So there was something of the little beginnings, at least, of that sort of diamond quality of the Vajra. But then, yeah, the thunderbolt is that things do appear, and there's all the power of the flow of the mind continually producing new experiences, new sights, new sounds, yeah, new ideas, new feelings, and you can't stop that. That's the really kind of unstoppable aspect of the Vajra, is that yes, there's all this, everything's ungraspable, but it keeps on coming. And it's when we try to stop it, when we try to cling on and say, no, okay, thanks, we'll just freeze things here so I can hold on to this moment because I really like this one. Yeah. That's when the Vajra smashes through, yeah, our ideas about how we want life to be, and that's when we suffer. Yeah. There's this constant power of the mind, the constant flow of the mind, but there's always the stability if you can just go and see that it's all in this kind of space of awareness, ungraspable. All right, so that's a few thoughts about the Vajra. So as what we've been doing is, at the end of each of the talks, we've been just making some suggestions for things that you can look at in discussion groups. And you don't have to look at all of them, as I said before, they're not homework, but they're things that you might find interesting to pick up as you explore the Dharma and explore how to take your practice deeper over these days. So here are a few for you. How do you relate to the image of Akshobhya, and especially to the image of the Vajra, to the diamond thunderbolt? And then, do you allow your rational faculty to be the one way of approaching the world among several, or does it kind of maintain a monopoly over how and what you let yourself experience? Are you open to really exploring feeling, exploring the senses, exploring myth, exploring ritual, you know, your rational faculty often really doesn't like ritual because it kind of comes from an angle that it can't cover. So all that sort of area. You could even look at, do you take yourself seriously as a Dharma practitioner? Yeah. How do you work with anger? Could you make something of that sort of unhooking method that I described? Does that make sense to you? And lastly, is there a wisdom element in your practice? Are you exploring, kind of comparing what you're telling yourself about the world to how it actually is? Are you drawing on the wisdom element of Buddhism, the conditionality, impermanence, things being ungraspable and empty, and so on? Is that something that, you know, you talk about on retreats, or is it actually coming into the way in which you approach life and situations? And are you managing to get underneath the story that you tell yourself, more into your direct experience to see how things really are. So there are a few things coming out of this talk on Akshobhya.